Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Monday, July 6th. We've got 65 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City, 66 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Monday, KPCW listeners. Hopefully everyone had a great holiday weekend, but as we get back to the moving and going of regular things out there, we're going to be looking at more summer-like conditions building in. Look for partly cloudy skies as we go throughout your Monday afternoon. Oh, it's going to be hot out there. We're going to see those temperatures in the upper 80s for us in Park City. We're talking high temperatures in the low 90s for us in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Tuesday, we'll continue with the partly cloudy skies out there. Temperatures, once again, in the upper 80s for highs in Park City, highs in the low 90s once again in the Heber Valley. Now, both today and tomorrow, there will be a chance of a couple of isolated pop-up showers and storms in the mountains. Again, this is going to be primarily high-based shower and storm activity, but overall, there will be that chance continuing out there for us. As we move into your Wednesday, look for mostly sunny skies, hot conditions around with upper 80s for highs in Park City. We'll be back in the low 90s in the Heber Valley. Now, as we head towards the end of the work week, we're going to start to track some more significant changes building into the region. We're going to have a strong ridge of high pressure, a heat dome that is going to be hanging out mainly to our south as we go throughout most of this week. That'll keep it hot, but the very hot conditions stay to our south. But that thing reloads and begins to build right back right on top of Utah as we head towards your Friday into the weekend, and that is going to bring us the hottest temperatures so far this summer season, and again, some just very hot conditions that could be dangerous to the body, particularly if you're not staying hydrated and you're not cooling down effectively. So with that being said, as we go into your Friday, look for lots of sunshine. High temperatures will be around 90 degrees in Park City, but we're going to be in the mid to upper 90s for a high temperature in the Heber Valley. But it gets even warmer Saturday. We're talking mostly sunny skies, highs in the mid-90s in Park City. We're talking highs in the triple digits in the Heber Valley, and we stay that way on your Sunday with highs in the upper 90s in Park City, highs in the 100 to 105 range in the Heber Valley. Yikes. That's the latest on your forecast for the Wasatch Back on ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up this hour, I'll be checking in with Rob Lee, a longtime Park City resident who just set a new world record, becoming the first person to do what's called the double seven. And also be checking in with Heber City Manager Matt Brower, the Heber City Council meeting Tuesday. And finally, from High Country Fly Fishers Conservation, we'll be talking with Chair Jane Guise and member Pat Ronenberg about their efforts to restore a portion of Soapstone Creek to help keep the wildfire debris and ash out of the Provo headwaters. Longtime Park City resident Rob Lee just set a new world record, becoming the first person to do what's called the double seven. That's summiting the highest peak on each continent while also swimming the world. So iconic open water channels. He joins me now in the studio. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I'm sorry. I know that we had tried to get your wife, Caroline Gleick, on to join us because I know she was such an integral part of this happening. So
absolutely. She, you know, it seems like an individual type of a sport, me out there swimming, but it was, you can't do this without your team, and she was there every step of the way. So wish she could have been here, but maybe next time.
Okay. Well, congratulations. I mean, this is pretty incredible. How are you feeling after last Tuesday's, I think, channel swim?
Honestly, a little tired and a little bit relieved. Yeah, this was a long-term project. I didn't really know that I was going to be, you know, signing up for this when I started it 17 years ago. Was when I did the first of the seven summits. I did the first of the ocean swims in 2019. So this has been a long-term project, and it got me to travel all around the world and try these different events, but also see the culture and all kinds of amazing adventures. So it's kind of bittersweet to have it done. It's one of those checklists that you look forward to kind of checking off the next one, and I don't have one to check off. You know, it's exciting to finish it, but I'll miss that checklist.
Yeah, and I don't know if you can do it off the top of your head, but for listeners who may not be familiar with what the double seven is, I mean, what is it What does it entail?
Yeah, so the Seven Summits, a lot of folks are familiar with. That's the highest mountain on each continent. So I started with Aconcagua, the highest mountain in South America, Denali, the highest mountain in North America, climbed Mount Everest with Caroline in 2019, moved on to, let me see if I can do this in order, but I believe it was Vince Massif, the highest in Antarctica. We had Kilimanjaro that I got to climb with my folks. And then we had the Puncak Jaya, or Carson's Pyramid, in Indonesia. And I recently climbed and skied Mount Blanc in Europe. And as far as the Ocean 7, this is a kind of a newer list. It's probably 20 years old or so. So these are seven iconic swims around the world. The first one I did was the English Channel from England to France. Then I did the Catalina Channel in California. I did the Cook Strait in New Zealand from the South Island to the North Island. Molokai Channel was my most recent one before this, Japan. That's between Molokai and Oahu. We've got the Strait of Gibraltar between Europe and Africa. And then I've got just did the Suguru Strait between the islands of Japan there from Honshu to Hokkaido. Did I miss any there?
North Channel?
North Channel, of course. That's one of the more difficult ones between Ireland and Scotland. A very cold swim and one of the most difficult on the list.
Yeah, so I guess what inspired you to pursue this?
It's a good question. I mean, I did the, in 2019, actually it kind of starts a little further back in 2017. I had some ankle injuries and I went to the doctor and I kind of knew what they were going to say, but they confirmed that I needed surgery on my ankle. I've been an athlete my whole life and I've also had a lot of injuries. And I know that when I go to PT and I've got a broken bone or something else that I need heal, I need something to train for. So literally sitting on the doctor's table, I decided I was going to swim the English Channel. I've been a swimmer my whole life, but I'd done some open water swimming with my triathlon background, but nothing in the open water like the English Channel or these other swims. So, I decided that I was going to swim the English Channel. I found some blogs online about what's harder at Mount Everest or the English Channel, and I thought, I wonder if anybody's done both. And it turned out there had been nine people, but they was always spread out by a number of years, and I decided I was going to try to swim the English Channel and climb Everest within a calendar year. It's called the Peak and Pond Challenge, or a calendar Peak and Pond Challenge. So I did that, and then because of my triathlon background, I ended up riding my bike across the country in that same year. Actually, it all happened in a six-month period. After I did the English Channel, I guess I just kind of got that open water swim bug. I wasn't really familiar with the Ocean 7 Challenge before that. I think, again, just kind of needing something to train for and keep my swimming going, I decided to start training for Catalina. Once I'd done two and I had a number of the seven summits under my belt, I came up with the idea of this double seven. I don't think I would have ever come up with that challenge without Caroline's influence. She's a huge influence, and she always dreams big, as people might know here in Park City. And so, you think, oh, the English Channel, that's a big challenge, but then you think of this bigger challenge, and she was a big influence on that.
Yeah, so the seven summits we know because of the...
Sure.
The tallest on a continent. How are the swimming straits chosen to be part of this double seven?
They're just seven iconic swims around the world. There's a guy, Steve Munatones, who came up with this, I think it was about 15 to 20 years ago. So the Seven Summits has a lot more folks that have accomplished that goal. There's not a really great count on it, but I'd say over 1,000 people have probably done the Seven Summits by this point. The Ocean Seven, I'm still trying to figure out my exact number, but I think I was the 46th person to finish that challenge. And I was the first person to do both of these challenges together.
So of the seven summits, which mountain proved to be the most difficult?
I mean, it's hard to say that Mount Everest isn't the most difficult because it's the highest. That last 1,000 feet on Mount Everest, man, you really feel that elevation. And you've got all the things to deal with aside from that, whether it's potentially even crowds like we had in 2019. And we were able to have a pretty awesome summit, just our team. But you're dealing with the weather and the jet stream and all these kind of things. But every single mountain and every swim had its own challenge. And that was what was really, interesting about this challenge, but I was lucky enough to get it done.
So this last one in Japan, Suguru.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing that may have challenged you the most because you had attempted it a few years ago and weren't unable to finish?
Yeah, it was the only one of these that I didn't get on the first try. So this was a redemption swim. When I did it in 2023, they had some new rules that year that made it kind of virtually impossible to get it. So when I got in the water, unfortunately, I kind of knew that I had a very small chance of getting it. One of the rules is that you can't swim at night there. If you can think of, people might, again, be more, used to like the mountains. And if you were only able to climb these mountains during the daytime hours, because of weather and wind, it would make it very difficult. And these channels are no different. The tides pick up, the currents pick up, and the weather picks up during the day. The Japanese had a boating accident. It had nothing to do with swimming, but they had a boating accident a few years before that swim. So they only let you swim during the night, during the day, not during the night. And that made that channel much more difficult. They also had a rule that you couldn't cross this kind of imaginary line that year. So I wasn't able to do it. That being said, the Suguru Strait ended up being one of the more difficult, but I can't overlook Molokai was really tested me and put me in the hospital with what's called SIPE. It's swimming-induced pulmonary edema. So at the very end of that swim, I thought I was drowning. I thought my heart was like pounding out of its own chest. And I literally, with even a couple hundred yards to go after a 14-plus hour swim, I didn't know if I was going to make the shoreline. I was able to get there, but it put me in the hospital. So that one, I think I would have to say tested me the most. The North Channel is such a cold swim with really heavy currents and tides, and that one's and the jellyfish on that one are really bad. But the Suguru Strait was it's very unpredictable with the tides and the currents, and that's exactly what happened on this swim. It was going all too well for the first 5-6 hours, and then the currents picked up a little earlier than expected, picked up the strength of the tide as well. So I had about five knots of current to deal with. So as I'm trying to make my way north, the current was pushing me to the east, and that basically just added hours and hours onto my swim.
So again, these are all saltwater swims, and the salt in and of itself creates some issues. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, swimming in the ocean, obviously you've got all the different factors, whether it's sea life. The salt actually does help buoyancy to a certain extent, so that's kind of nice, but you have to protect yourself against it as well. So I cover myself in zinc oxide. Actually, I use Desitin, which is baby diaper rash cream. It's the only thing that will stay on as a protective barrier for the sun. So I put that on, and then I put on bag balm or Vaseline. I've been using bag balm all through my armpits and different areas of my body, because any little area that's going to rub for 10 hours, in this case, the Suguru Strait was 11 and a half hour swim, you're going to get chafing. So I've got lots of chafing in my neck. My tongue and my mouth basically kind of fall apart. You can kind of peel off all the skin, and it has to regrow after these swims. So the salt water is certainly a challenge.
Yeah. Are you a swimmer where you can, that you swim both sides, you turn your head both sides?
I do, but I generally breathe on the right side. Mm-hmm. So the boat pilot, as they're called in our world, the captain, he was able to have me on the left side of the boat so that I breathe to the right. And so I can kind of see the boat every time I breathe to that side. There was, I think it was only about a half hour, the wind really picked up and the waves really picked up from that left side. So they had me switch sides of the boat, and I'm able to breathe to both sides, but I prefer to breathe to the right.
And the deal is that you don't get to touch a boat.
Yeah, right? There's a lot of rules on these open water swims for them to be ratified. So I can't wear a wetsuit. Basically, it's a cap, goggle, and Speedo. You can wear nose plugs and earplugs if you'd like. On some of the swims, they allow you to use a shark band that just is kind of a magnet that's supposed to fend off the sharks, because there are definitely sharks out there. But generally speaking, you can't touch the boat. I do get a feeding, and I generally do those every half hour. So my crew on the boat will have a water bottle with liquid calories. That's on a string. We actually use a retractable dog leash. They throw that to me. I drink half a water bottle every half hour, so I get about, 170 calories, 175 calories every half hour. And I try to do those as quick as possible. But my head's in the water, so it's kind of nice to have that couple seconds of human interaction with the crew as well.
Yeah, and as one who like gets in and think I'm going to do laps, I mean, after 20 minutes, I'm like, I'm just bored. Where do you go for 11 hours while you're swimming?
I think there's a lot of things. When you know you've got something like a 6, 8, 10, 12-hour swim ahead of you, you are just biting off in chunks. I'm trying to make it to that next feeding every half hour. But also, when you know you have that long of a swim coming up, on this Suguru Strait, the first half hour, I thought, man, that went by really fast. It felt like 10 minutes. And that happened for the first few hours. For, I would say, the first 2 or 3 hours, I felt like I was just ticking away the miles and the time. While I'm out there, you know, I'm thinking about obviously kind of what my body is feeling and how I'm doing. I'm figuring out exactly where I am compared to the boat and just kind of taking it all in. It's special to be out there in the middle of the ocean and kind of have it all yourself and think, man, I'm crossing this ocean. But of course, your mind is going to wander to everything from family to friends to work to anything in between.
Yeah. I saw on one of your social media posts someone kind of body shaming you, questioning how you could swim given your body weight. Maybe you could explain that as you did to that critic.
Yeah, sure. It's kind of funny after you finish these kind of things, you always have a couple of naysayers there, especially online. In this case, someone said, oh gosh, aren't you a little fat, I think, to be doing this kind of a challenge. And actually, open water swimming, you really generally want to have a couple extra pounds on you. Certainly is not going to hurt your buoyancy, but the main reason is to keep you warm. So in 2019, after I climbed Everest and I had the English Channel coming up, 45 days later, in fact, I put on 30 pounds in 30 days. I knew that I had the swimming capabilities to get across that channel, but you can only do so much if you get hypothermia. So I really had to pack on some pounds to basically insulate me from the cold and make sure that I could survive that cold. I spent years in cold baths and in cold lakes, and when I could, oceans. But of course, here we are in Park City, it's harder to get to the ocean. But I spent years trying to pack on the pounds and get used to that water physically, but also mentally. You really have to wrap your head around being in really cold water for a long time, particularly for that North Channel swim, which was, the water was 54 degrees, and I was in that water for 10 and a half hours. So you really have to train to allow your body to do that.
Yeah, so packing on the weight, just what, lots of carbs?
Yeah, I think before that English Channel swim, I had two sponsors, and one of them was Red Banjo Pizza, and one of them was Fat Tire Beer. So I was drinking quarts of whole milk and whatever I could just to pack on the pounds. Ideally, you're putting on brown fat, and you put that on a little bit more naturally by being in cold situations. But I had to do what I had to do in 2019 to get some extra pounds on.
Yeah, and so you mentioned, I mean, these are cold water open swims. How does that cold change? What's the difference between, you know, and then being the top of Everest where it's, I mean, it's so cold too.
Yeah, the difference with the swims is that you're literally in a Speedo. So on Everest, you can put on another layer or you can do different things to try to warm yourself up. But that, I think that's what that's why there is this debate about what's harder, kind of the English Channel or Everest, because on the swims, you're stripped down. It's you against the ocean. On these climbs, you potentially, you know, you can put on more clothes, or on certain climbs, you might have help from Sherpas and different things like that. So I think that's what makes it interesting, is that you're stripped down to you and the ocean in a Speedo.
Yeah. And then in terms of recovery for your body between, you know, climbing altitude and cold water swimming, is how long does it take to recover?
I mean, Everest, you're in the death zone for, you know, days or kind of weeks on end, and that's really taxing on your body. Your body is basically slowly eating itself and slowly dying. So that one, you really just need to kind of nourish your body when you get back, and it definitely took a few weeks to get back to normal and feel normal. On these swims, I generally recover relatively quickly. I'm about a week out from my last swim and I'm starting to feel a little bit normal. Of course, I've got the jet lag and all that kind of stuff still setting in, but I'm starting to feel normal. After Molokai, that one took a good 2 to 3 months of recovery because I think I did some damage to my lungs with that SIP. So it took a little while, but generally speaking, I recover pretty quick.
Yeah, that's what edema is, kind of fluid on the lungs?
Fluid in the lungs. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. But no problems as a result of that?
No, I think after about 2 months, I started training a little bit, and after 3 months, my lungs felt pretty normal.
Yeah. So adventure sports always involve risk. I guess, how do you distinguish between pushing through discomfort and recognizing it's time to turn back?
It's always a calculated risk. And I would say the one that stands out is that Molokai, that I probably put myself in a little bit of a dangerous situation there. It was dark. I was landing at what's called Sandy Beach, which is the most dangerous beach in the United States. They have more spinal cord injuries and neck injuries on that beach than any beach in the United States. And I was exhausted trying to get through those waves and get on the beach. So, you know, there's some calculated risk there. I guess I look at it in the sense that I have trained for these, and you train as well as you can to mitigate that risk. I'm honestly more afraid of getting in a car accident or of cancer. I'm much more afraid of those things, things that are slightly more out of my control than these challenges that I would say generally are in my control.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, how has this journey perhaps changed your approach to challenges just in everyday life?
Yeah, I mean, when I started, you know, the Ultimate World Triathlon and then this Double 7 Challenge, I would say, you know, I knew I could push my body and my mind, but I really had no idea. And I think that doing a challenge like this just shows me that, you know, your mind and body are capable of a lot more than you really know. And if there's anything to take away from this, I would say I hope other folks understand that we're capable of a lot more than we think. I think we live in a pretty comfortable world, generally speaking, from our, you know, our air conditioned or heated home to our air conditioned a car to the office or whatever else. And I feel like we really experience living outside of that comfort zone. You get that full range of emotion on these type of a challenges where you get the highest of the highs and the lowest of the lows. And that's where I feel most alive.
Yeah. So do you have another challenge out there somewhere?
Mostly just resting. I do have one kind of challenge coming up in the fall. Caroline and I are going to run the New York Marathon, doing that for charity, so I'll be on the climate team for that. I think that'll be more of a fun run than it will be for absolute fastest time I can run it, but that's going to be pretty fun, going from the type of thing where it's me and my crew and a couple of folks in the middle of the ocean to the New York Marathon, I think, has 65,000 participants. So it'll be really fun to be a part of something like that.
All right. Well, congratulations. It's just amazing. So
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Looking good.
Okay.
Thanks Rob. Bye. That's Rob Lee again, who has just completed the Double 7. Well, the Heber City Council meets Tuesday in work session starting at 4:00. And on the phone with a preview of the meeting, I have Heber City Manager Matt Brower. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Leslie. Hope you had a great July 4.
Yeah, I sure did. And I was going to ask you, how did Heber City's 4th of July celebration go?
It was extraordinary, a wonderful event. I think everyone who attended had a great time.
Okay. Any highlights for you personally?
I was in the cast of 1776, and we ran 8 shows, and most were sold out, and we had standing ovations, just a truly amazing musical, amazing event, and amazing 4th of July.
Oh, what role did you play?
I played Joseph Hughes, a delegate from North Carolina.
Okay, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, so work session starts with a discussion about the Celebration Housing Development Agreement. This is a 9-acre workforce and affordable community plan for essential employees located near Wasatch High School. I think 148 apartments. Do you have the final numbers on this? Because at one point there was also going to be an affordable hotel.
Yeah, the plan is in flux a little bit. The discussion that will focus at the Tuesday council meeting is on the parking. The current zoning designation requires, I think, 296 spaces. They've got 271. So the question is, how do we resolve that? They had hoped initially to leverage some public parking at the Wasatch High School. The school board has subsequently said no to that. And so discussion will be on parking and making sure there's sufficient parking for the project, particularly phase one.
Interesting, because I think some of these units are intended for teachers, yeah?
That is correct. It's intended to be workforce housing. It's located near the hospital, located near the Wasatch High School. It's located near retail. And so absolutely, it's intended to be for teachers and nurses and those that need essential housing.
So what do you think? I mean, is it worth making an exception for? Or do you need to reduce the number of units?
Well, that's part of the discussion. The thought is, well, maybe we allow them to go forward with the requested number of 271 and then look at phase two, to see if modifications need to be made to the parking, either more parking, less parking, or go with what's been proposed. So subsequent phases allow some pivoting in the project.
All right, so besides the parking, are there any more stumbling blocks? I mean, all the other I's have been dotted and T's crossed?
Well, the parking is a big one. The other one, of course, is the development agreement, which has always a lot of details in it, which we'll have to work through. We're not presenting the development agreement tonight. That will be at a subsequent meeting. That will be the second hurdle to get through with that agreement approval.
All right. Following that discussion will be a presentation from the Utah Housing Corp about federal and state funding tools and low-income housing tax credits. These are known as LIHTC. This is what, just mostly informational?
That is correct. Last January, my council asked for more information broadly on affordable housing. So we put together this Affordable Housing 101 series. We had our first series back in May. This is the second class. It's 10 total. That'll take us through the summer and early fall. Claudie O'Grady will be in town from Utah Housing Corp talking about low-income housing tax credits for the intent of trying to get my council informed and up to date on everything affordable housing.
All right. Are any projects using those LIHTC credits?
No, we've had a lot of discussions about LIHTC credits, but to be quite frank with you, there's not much known about it in my community, so we're hoping to learn more and hopefully use it as a tool in our toolbox.
All right. Council will also consider some new options for a future intersection. This is at 1200 South and Mill Road. Have they decided on one?
We're looking at a roundabout, and the discussion that will take place Tuesday is the design of the roundabout. How many lanes? How should it be designed? How large should it be? How much property are we going to need to purchase in order to build a roundabout? So staff's goal Tuesday is to update council on some design features and hopefully get their favorable approval.
All right. I think I was reading that they were concerned that a roundabout won't work for future traffic demands. Are you trying to build one that will meet future traffic?
That's correct. The intersection now comes close to failure in the AM and PM peak periods. And so we're trying to leverage more roundabouts in the community. We think they have more curb appeal, more functional, and design one that will get us well beyond 2050.
Yeah. Now, is this a city project? And I mean, it's city dollars that'll be used to build it?
That is correct. It's in it's actually on the 12th South Mill Road. So the county sits to the east of this intersection, the city to the west of it. We have talked to the county about participating, and we'll see if we can get some participation. Otherwise, it will be a city project.
All right. The council will also be recognizing Don Taylor. He's retiring as the longtime Mountain Lands Association of Governments trail coordinator. Just some recognition here?
Yeah, he has been an ally of local trails. He's worked very closely with me and my staff on the development and master planning of trails, and he is looking to retire. We're looking to honor him for his great work in the trail community.
All right. There will also be a public hearing for the Highlands PIDs. This is basically to serve an affordable housing development, I believe 811 units on 116 acres. At least one council member that I know of is concerned that the city may be overextending the number of PIDs, or public infrastructure districts, that are getting approved. What about you?
So the city currently has five PIDs. All five are located in the Jordan Elk Ridge. They were approved back in, I think, 2020, so it's been some period of time. We're looking at three more PIDs with this Highlands, the Highlands Project. And they serve a purpose. They can facilitate infrastructure improvements. Rather than phasing it, they can complete it all at once. In this particular case, the developers are saying that the savings they will glean by utilizing the PID will be used to lower the entry-level housing cost, which is unique. And we'll see if we can come up with some terms and how much that savings might be.
Okay, that's interesting, because how much would this PID add to an owner's property tax bill? Because those who buy in this project will be responsible for repaying those PIDs.
That's correct. The way the PID works is it can't be more than five mills, and the actual mills that are approved would be assessed against each property owner, and it's based upon the mills in the project. I don't have that number for you right now. But yes, each property owner will be required to pay their small proportionate share of it. They pay in conjunction with their typical property tax bill. But the notion here is that the essential housing or the affordable housing would have savings that would be far beyond the additional tax they'd pay to the PID.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, I would like to see those numbers because it seems, it just seems counterintuitive here, right? That they are going to be paying additional taxes. And then how does that make it more affordable?
Yeah, the savings in the presentation show thousands of dollars of savings in terms of the purchase price of the home. The annual payment to PID, as I understand it, would be around $200 or $300. And so you're talking $200 or $300 a year in additional property tax versus upfront savings of thousands of dollars. So it allows people to get into homes that are becoming very hard to afford.
All right. Let's see. The city also looking for council authorization to begin the Main Street Plaza design and to hire a construction management contractor. So is the master plan final and approved?
The council has essentially signaled their support for a design. The item on tomorrow night's agenda is to begin the process of schematic design. What that means is to take the design to 30% of drawing. The reason for that is at 30%, we'd be able to get a more accurate cost estimate. We'd be able to take a look at the phasing. They'll take a look at the real impacts of where the things will sit at the park and make adjustments, if warranted, before continuing and completing the design process.
Okay. That contract is for almost $400,000, and at this point, we don't know what the total price tag of the project would be?
We have an estimate that was given to council earlier. It's approximately, I think, $15 to $18 million. With 30% schematic designs done, we'll be able to get a lot more accurate cost estimates for the park. And council may ultimately decide at 30% to maybe scale something back, maybe to scale something up. Gives them the option to really take a look at the project and pivot as they see warranted.
Okay. It also sounds like the city has a plan for the three buildings that it bought from the Wasatch Wave and Heber Power and Light in downtown Heber City. It sounds like for now you're just planning to lease them?
Several of the buildings, staff's going to propose that we lease them for a period of time. We're not ready to raise them or demolish them at this time. I feel like the best use is to lease them commercially. The question mark really is the old Heber Light and Power building that we purchased some years ago. Heber Light and Power is now in their brand new administration building over on 6th West. And so the question comes, do we go ahead and raise this building now and create more parking, which we're in desperate need of, or do we keep the building standing and use it for other community purposes?
Okay. So at this point, we don't really know what the ultimate plan is. Is it for those buildings to come down?
Staff is going to propose that Heber Light and Power building be considered to be raised at this time, but the other buildings, we look at commercial leases not just any commercial lease, but leases to retail and restaurants that would be open in the evenings and on weekends to help create that vibrancy we so much need in the downtown area.
Okay, Matt, anything else you want to mention?
Just want to say thank you to the Red, White, and Blue Festival Board. Did an amazing job with the 4th of July festival this past weekend. And I think anyone who attended would attest to just how great of an event it was.
Okay, Matt, I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Matt Brower is the city manager for Heber City. High Country Fly Fishers Conservation Project plans to restore a portion of Soapstone Creek to help keep the wildfire debris and ash out of the Provo headwaters. In the studio with details, I have Gene Guys, Vice President of the High Country Fly Fishers and Chair of the Conservation Committee, along with a member of the committee, Pat Ronenberg. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jane, many people know High Country Fly Fishers as a fishing club, but conservation is a big portion of your mission. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. So we are the Park City chapter of TU, and our primary mission is conservation. And we're also a fishing club, but conservation is Trout Unlimited's primary mission, and that is what this project is based on. We got a grant from an Embrace a Stream grant from Trout Unlimited for $10,000, which has been matched and added to multiple times now for about $35,000, with the expectation that we could hit $70,000 by the time the project actually, you know, reaches completion.
Okay, well, tell us a little bit about the Soapstone Basin Restoration Project. I mean, what are you hoping to accomplish here?
Okay, so this project came about because of the Yellow Lake Fire that was in the fall of 2024. It burned 33,000 acres in the Uinta, Wasatch, Cache, and Ashley National Forest. This was the biggest fire in 2024. It impacted both the north and west forks of the Duchesne River drainage and also the Soapstone Basin and Mill Hollow area. So our project, because we are a Park City-based fishing club, is on the Provo side. That's where our focus always is. There is a parallel Trout Unlimited project that looks at the Duchesne on the other side. And the idea is that this will keep a lot of the ash and fire debris out of the headwaters of our very beloved Provo River.
So Soapstone Basin up there off of State Highway 150?
Right, between the Mirror Lake Highway and Highway 35, the Mill Hollow area. It's kind of in where we are restoring is that in-between area. It can be approached from either side.
So why is this such an important area for the Provo River watershed?
Well, it is the headwaters of the Provo, and the idea is not only will it keep the ash out of Soapstone Creek, the ash and debris, but it will keep that from entering the Provo and all of the waters down below, you know, the Provo that the Provo feeds.
Yeah, what does the ash do to the water?
Well, it kills the fish, for starters, and depending on how bad it is, it can impact water quality, you know, which will hit our drinking water. The snowpack this year was so light, there wasn't a lot of runoff, so we were spared the runoff this year, and hopefully the work that's done, you know, in August with us will be enough to hold that back in future years where the runoff is hopefully a lot better.
Yeah. So the ash contains like what, carbon? I mean, is that what, I'm just trying to figure out what ash.
It kills the fish. It smothers the fish. Yeah. And this is also, you know, the idea is it has to do with the cutthroat population here in the state too. Do you know what the water?
No, I don't know exactly what the chemicals are. We're mostly concerned about the fish themselves, and it's actually a physical process where the ash gets into their gills and they just can't absorb the oxygen that they need.
Okay.
So, and we've seen this repeatedly in other fire areas.
So have you guys completed similar restoration projects elsewhere in the state?
Well, not for the fires, not for fires that I'm aware of, but we have planted willows all around Strawberry Reservoir over the last 15 years. We've had multiple projects around that area, and you know, it's really rewarding to go back and see where, like, the grazing and whatnot, the cows had pretty much just stomped the little creeks to nothing. And now there's creeks that hold water, and, you know, the fish can spawn in those, and they hold water year-round. And
So you're looking for volunteers to help with the restoration project. I mean, how many volunteers can you use?
So we have been asked by Trout Unlimited to gather 200 volunteers. So it's a big number for our high country fly fishers. But as of right now, we have about 100 who are signed up. And if you sign up on High Country Fly Fishers, the activities page, you'll go to that page, and that is how you could get additional information. We're sending out regular volunteer information packets and information as we gather it for what the work will be and that kind of thing. We also have several partners who have shared our, you know, advertising of our project. And could I just mention a few of the ones that have helped the most? It's Trina Hedwig of DWR and Blue Ribbon. She also helped us with Dedicated Hunters. Jared Winkler of Fish for Garbage. Rose Smith and Sierra Hastings of Sageland. Scott E. Wasaki of the Park Record. Our sister Trout Unlimited and Fly Fishers International clubs, including Heber Valley Flycasters. Also Tate Shaw of the Park City Youth Recreation Program, the fishing programs. David Smart and Vicky Plum of Surf Park City and Just Serve. And the Park City newcomers, Heather Turkin and Kathy Van Dyke. And then, of course, the local fly shops, Trout Bum 2, Fish West of Camas, and Fish Heads in Heber.
Great. So what kind of restoration work will volunteers be doing?
So we are restoring a mile and a half of the Soapstone Creek. The work is going to be building beaver dam analogs. These are basically starter beaver dams. So heavy equipment will be used before our work days to put posts, like little 3-4 inch posts, in the creek bed, and the volunteers will cut willows and weave them into that. And as the water comes down, this will slow the flow and also catch the ash and debris. The idea is that build it and they will come and the beavers will show up. We'll also be cutting and staking willows where there's wet areas or should wet areas develop with the beaver dam analogs. And we'll be sowing and planting native grasses and plants in the burn area and around the Soapstone Creek.
All right, so do you need to go back in, though, and kind of clean the ash debris out?
We won't. We'll just... At least that's not the plan.
Okay. Yeah.
That I guess it could create a situation where we would have to, but that is not part of the current plan. It's just this mile and a half of the creek with the idea that future projects that may or may not be high country fly fishers would then extend up and down the creek.
So do volunteers need any special experience or?
They do not. Mm-hmm. And the task will be dividing the workforce into groups of probably 4. And then we'll send them out in groups to the work area and they'll be trained. There will be tasks for people of all ages and activity levels. So, you know, you can choose your task, what that might involve. We ask that children under the age of 12 and pets not come to the event for safety concerns. Minors, anybody between 12 and 18, 12 and 17, need to be with a parent or guardian, and then, you know, that's how we'll do it.
Okay. Do they need to bring any equipment or supplies
with
them?
They don't. If you have a favorite tool, like your favorite loppers, put your name on it so you get it back. But High Country and Trout Unlimited will provide all the tools. We'll also provide lunch, snacks, waters, that kind of thing. There will be bathrooms set up at the work area, which is a good ways off of Highway 35 and 150.
Okay, when is this all happening?
So our big work day is Saturday, August 8th. Then we have work days during the week, and it'll be an all-day thing, like from 9 to 4. And then we have two that week, August 12th and 14th, and then the final work day will be that Saturday, the following Saturday, the 15th.
Okay, and again, people can just go online and...
Yes, High Country Fly Fishers, the activities page. Look for volunteers needed for Soapstone on activities, and that's where you would sign up.
Yeah, so I guess how are you going to measure whether the project's been successful?
Well, Trout Unlimited, when we completed our grant, there are measures of the success, and part of that is we'll go back and look at the area, and, you know, if we planted willows and none survived, that would not be a success. If the beaver dam analogs, you know, are not holding water, but a maximum success would be lots of live willows in beaver ponds that the beavers have moved into.
All right. And so the money's been being spent then on just supplies?
Well, posts, heavy equipment. There's a good bit of heavy equipment work that is going on in advance of this. Supplies, posts, seeds, some tools, that sort of thing.
Okay. And Pat, I mean, I guess beyond fishing, why should residents along the Wasatch Back care about the health of these headwaters?
Oh, golly, there's so many reasons for that, especially with the water year that we're just having right now. We need to try to protect and foster it. One of the problems with these fires is they create a situation where the water does not go back into its natural channel. It goes directly into the earth. Now, it may come out someplace else, but then again, it may not. And we need these headwaters, for one thing, to support the efforts to support the Great Salt Lake, because that's where all of the water on the Wasatch Front ends up going, is into the Great Salt Lake. We can't afford to be losing our headwaters in this way. It just, it doesn't bode well for our future in the valley, for everyone. So.
Yeah, and as we know, the Provo River is one of Utah's premier, you know, blue ribbon trout fisheries. I mean, have you noticed any differences over the years?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm a Utah resident, and I have seen it go through many, many, many changes. I'm extremely grateful for the mitigation project that was put in place after Jordanelle Dam was built so that we have access to that wonderful corridor over there. And I've seen how it is used, and it is used every day, all day long, by hundreds of people. I couldn't be more grateful for that. So, yeah, it's so important.
Yeah, but have you seen any degradation, I guess, over the years?
You know, it's interesting, because there's been changes to the fishery, because when I was a kid fishing it, we were fishing in ditches. It was great. I loved it. but it's not like that anymore. Now you have to be pretty technical to figure out what's going on over there. So there's been changes. I wouldn't necessarily say it's been degradation. I would say there's been many, many changes. And it's hard to say what's gone on above Jordanelle, because that's all private and we see so little of it. But when we start getting into the forest, we do see it. And I do think human use to it, we need to be respectful of the resource, and we need to understand it a little bit, and we need to help it when it's in trouble like it is right now.
Okay. Anything else, Jane or Pat, that you wanted to mention?
No, we just hope to see lots of Park City residents there. Thank you very much, and thanks for the opportunity,
yes.
Leslie.
Thank you so much, Leslie. Oh,
you bet. That's Jane Guise and Pat Ronenberg with the High Country Fly Fishers Conservation Project. Wasatch County and Maverick Rock have agreed to a legal settlement meant to mitigate the environmental impacts of mining in Daniels Canyon. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports the county is still fighting the project's approval in court.
After a court-ordered public hearing in April, Maverick Rock was granted permission to mine in Daniels Canyon. Wasatch County is fighting that decision in a court of appeals case, but in the meantime, it must comply with state requirements to move the project forward. Deputy County Attorney Alex Stoder told the council Wednesday a settlement agreement lets the county require limited environmental mitigation while it waits for the higher court's decision.
I know the council isn't wanting to do this, but I think we have to recognize, given the situation we're in, this is the best outcome we can get for now while we continue to fight on appeal.
In other words, Stoder said something is better than nothing. The settlement agreement comes after county leaders said the mine could endanger the public. It includes mitigation measures for water, air quality, traffic, and more. The land in question is over 400 acres along US 40 south of Heber. Maverick plans to extract 1 million tons of limestone and quartzite from the Daniels Canyon site every year. Councilmember Luke Searle wanted more time to decide, but Stoder said the settlement agreement was time sensitive.
We've done everything we can to get the best deal we can. If we continue it to next week, it could be gone. I'm pretty confident it will be.
Without a settlement, Maverick wouldn't need to follow the county's requests. It could also file a new lawsuit, leaving any mitigation measures up to a judge. Councilmember Mark Nelson agreed the settlement was the best option available.
It's as unsavory as it is. I think it's the best path for us.
Council members Mike Murphy, Eric Rowland, and Spencer Park agreed with him, voting to approve the settlement. Colleen Bonner and Luke Searle voted against it. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.